I'd like to introduce our participant and our respondent today. Our paper today is Mormonism and Unionism, a Unique Confrontation. The author is J. Kenneth Davies, Department Chair and Professor of Managerial Economics at Brigham Young University. You may be familiar with some of Ken's writings. He's had articles, I know, published in Dialogue, which you may have seen, and in other journals as well. He is the author of Deseret Sons of Toil, which is a history of the labor movement in Utah from the time of the early territorial times up until statehood. He's just recently published with Olympus Press a book called Mormon Gold, The Story of California's Mormon Argonauts, which I know he's anxiously been awaiting the publication of, as have many of us. Our comment today will be from Sam Stewart, who is president of Wasatch Advisors Incorporated and professor of finance at the University of Utah. Let me just say that I'm filling in and I have something else that I need to do, so I have to run and do that. I'm going to turn the time over to Ken for his presentation, and then Sam's going to make his comments, and then they're going to field questions at the balance for the balance of the time. It is now 4:15, and I think we can go until 4:30 without any problem. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you Ken Davies.
Thank you, John. Utah is one of a substantial minority of states maintaining an anti-union reputation and posture. The fact that it has come somewhat from the fact that it has been one of 20 states to pass and retain a right-to-work law. And that helped to establish the reputation. The assumption by the staunchly conservative Senator Orrin Hatch of the chairmanship of the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee only enhanced that public view, as did a recent article in the Church's Deseret News, which identified all five of Utah's Washington delegation as Mormon, who are all Mormons, as anti-union. While the reputation is perhaps an overstatement, Utah can in no wise be considered as pro-union, and perhaps it is even less than neutral on the subject. A better description would be that there is a substantial amount of negativism toward labor unions within the Utah body politic. This negativism exists to a considerable extent because of the historical development of a mutual antagonism between the Mormon Church and unionism. This mutual antagonism developed in spite of Mormon flirtation with budding unionism in Nauvoo and with the development of worker guilds and unions in Pioneer pre-railroad Deseret. The employees, an example of the unions, the employees of the Church's Deseret News, organized as early as 1852, were chartered as the Deseret Local 115 of the National Typographical Union in 1868. Their leaders were predominantly Mormons until the late 1880s. This local remains in existence today, having dropped the word Deseret. It may well be the only local union substantially consisting of workers employed and recognized, albeit directly, by the church. With the coming of the railroads in 1869, Gentiles began to flock into the Mormon Zion. Many were craftsmen, bringing with them union ideals flourishing in the East. They came at a time when the official policy of the church was in opposition to any intercourse between church members and non-Mormons. This policy was substantially influenced by the anti-Mormon efforts of General Patrick Connor in the 1863-68 period. The Mormon and Connor policies together did little to endear the established Mormon and the emerging Gentile apostate cultures to each other. The Gentile community understandably reacted against the non-intercourse policy, patronizing the Salt Lake Tribune, which was just commenced at that particular point in time, which became the spokesman for unions, mining, Gentiles, and apostates, taking over from Connor's anti-Mormon Union Vedette and the rebellious Utah Magazine. All of these groups became associated together in the minds of most Mormons, becoming tarred with the same brush. Every time a group of workers gave any evidence of organizing a union during the 1870s, the effort was lauded by the anti-Mormon Tribune as evidence of, quote, the widening breach between the Mormon Church and the people of the community, unquote. And then in the 1870s, the United Orders came into existence. And with those United Orders, the breach between the church and the workers, the unions, was widened. Many of the Mormon workers became associated in the United Orders, drawing them away from the still infant labor unions. Thus, the unions were deprived of the membership of the more active Mormons, who in turn lost any influence which they might have had with them. Increasingly, Utah unions would become Gentile apostate dominated. I'm not using this term apostate in a pejorative sense. It's simply a word descriptive of those who had left the Mormon faith. In the early 1880s, the Noble Order of Knights of Labor entered Utah as part of its rapid expansion throughout the nation. The Knights had publicly given up its former secrecy, but still had vestiges of its earlier history. This purported secrecy made church leaders a bit edgy. And when many of the Knights leaders in Utah became associated in the Liberal Party with the anti-Mormon forces in the area, this edginess turned to antagonism. The Deseret News condemned the Knights as a, quote, secret combination, condemned by the Book of Mormon, and the Saints were counseled not to be involved with them. Later that year, when it became known that the Knights were attempting to exclude faithful Latter-day Saints, the News maintained that such a policy would have a little effect, as there were but a, quote, a few stragglers, unquote, professing to be Mormons in the Union, and that these were, quote, of doubtful faith and standing, unquote, in the church. Several Mormon Knights took written and anonymous exception to the News, and by the way, it was published in the News, however, saying that there were quite a few Mormons in the Knights of Labor and other unions, their standing in the church being beyond question. The News backed off with a conciliatory, yet far from supportive editorial. However, the thought persisted. Faithful Saints would not be union members. The growing negativism toward unionism within Mormondom in the late 1800s was undoubtedly influenced by the growing middle-classness of its local leadership. While no known time series exists to show a trend, a recent paper shows Mormon bishops of that period to have been substantially more propertied than the male population in general. Utah's growing urban centers undoubtedly had increasing numbers of bishops who were budding capitalists. As workers began to organize in the 1870s and 80s, these bishops naturally developed a prejudice against organizations of working men, and there were very few women at that time in the movement, that could reduce their economic authority. Subsequent to a last-gasp regional convention of the Knights in the Salt Lake City in 1887, Utah workers became absorbed into the rapidly expanding organizational activities associated with the American Federation of Labor. Interestingly enough, the principal figure in the organization of Utah's crafts into the AFL was Robert Gibson Slater. A staunch editorial supporter of Brigham Young in the newspaper war of the 1870s and a long-term leader of Deseret Local 115 of the Typographical Union. He had even served a term as a vice president of the International Typographical Association in the 1870s, the first Utahn and Mormon to serve as a national officer. He was even a polygamist, might just add parenthetically, He scandalized many unionists when he entered his inaugural ball as the head of that organization in 1889 with a wife on each arm. I had that crossed out, but I thought I'd throw it in. In 1890, he was named as the organizer for the FFL in Utah, in 1890. Also that year, he almost single-handedly formed the Working Man's Party, which was politically allied with the church in an abortive attempt to control the Salt Lake County elections, an action which cost him the support of the majority of Salt Lake Union members. The nationwide depression at mid-decade saw the virtual collapse of the Utah labor movement, paralleling the national experience. But with the removal from the area during the decade of many of the more transient non-Mormons, the economic recovery, and the achievement of a Mormon long-sought-for statehood, the movement was reborn, with Slater reemerging as Utah's senior union statesman. As uneasy as had been the relationship between unionism and Mormonism during the first half century of Utah history, there had been an especially uneasy relationship developing between miners and Mormons. This uneasiness was initiated by the public yet ambivalent opposition of church leaders to precious metal mining. And that's the story, essentially, the beginning of that policy is the story that's found in the book that was referred to on Mormon gold, the story of California's Mormon Argonauts. This policy was generated during the gold rush days, out of the fear of the loss of manpower to the flesh pots of mining camps. It was cast into concrete in the 1860s by General Connor and his soldiers who were sent out as prospectors. The apparent conflict was increased when Utah miners generally became associated with the Knights of Labor in the 1880s. When the miners became involved with the Radical Western Federation of Miners in the 1890s, at the time Utah and the church were attempting to legitimize themselves as loyal Americans and believers in capitalism in the eyes of the nation, the die was cast. And then the Western Federation of Miners joined with revolutionaries and radicals in the formation of the Industrial Workers of the World shortly after the turn of the century, and Utah was made a principal center for their violence-oriented revolutionary brand of industrial unionism. Little question remained in the minds of Mormon leaders. Radicals, miners, unionists, apostates, anti-Mormon Gentiles, and their spokesman, the Tribune, were all of the same ilk. The dynamiting of the Hotel Utah construction by mainline unionists, the conviction and execution of the IWW's Joe Hill, for which the church was pilloried, and the opposition to the church supported prohibition by the Utah State Federation of Labor, all played a role in the increasing conflict between Mormonism and Unionism. But probably more important were two additional developments. One, the use of Mormons as strikebreakers and scabs, often with the encouragement of Mormon local and even regional church leaders. Such activity could not be looked on with any degree of tolerance by a true Unionist, Mormon or not. And two, the efforts of unions to establish closed shops. To Mormon leaders, this appeared to be an effort to foreclose employment to devout Mormons who, they assumed, were not involved in labor unions. Thus, the use of Mormons as strikebreakers had begun with the strike of the Independent Miners Union at Silver Reef near St. George in 1880, with the use of a largely Mormon posse to put down that strike. 3 years later, the largely Mormon coal miners of Pleasant Valley at the southeast corner of Utah County went on strike. President A.O. Smoot, Utah State President, pressured the men to return to work, helping to forge the reputation of Mormons as at least a potential strike-breaking force. With the attempts to organize the largely non-Mormon coal miners of Carbon County and the surrounding areas in the 1920s, Mormons more and more became involved as hated scabs and strikebreakers. However, it did not take long for the growing numbers of Mormon miners. They began as scabs and strikebreakers, but then they turned into miners. It didn't take long for Mormon miners to discover the need for a union, the United Mine Workers, to protect their interests. Mormon opposition to closed shops surfaced in 1890 when the typographical union, by then under non-Mormon leadership, attempted to force a closed shop at the Deseret News. Until that time, workers at Deseret News were union or non-union. It was an open shop, true open shop. It failed in its endeavor, calling for a boycott of the newspaper. As union membership skyrocketed in the early 1900s, Salt Lake employers formed a Citizens Alliance, the first right-to-work movement in Utah. And then in the 1920s, Utah became one of the nation's leaders in the right-to-work movement of that day, known as the American Plan. President Heber J. Grant and presiding Bishop Charles W. Nibley became strong public supporters of the movement. This resulted in increased antagonism toward the church by union workers. The American Plan played a significant role in the virtual demise of the labor movement in Utah and the nation by the time of the Great Depression. The anti-union stance of Mormon leaders might well have also been influenced by the rise to the leadership of the Utah State Federation of Labor of M.P. Bales, later a self-proclaimed communist, who under whom several state conventions in about 1920 passed pro-Russian resolutions. These actions may have driven some Mormon conservative unionists out of union activity. Then slipping into the 1930s, encouraged by the Wagner Act and economic regeneration in Utah and the nation, the workers began spontaneously to organize labor unions in the 1930s. A new spirit of democracy swept both the nation and Utah. Industrial democracy was born, even in Utah. With economic recovery, Utah's mining and smelting industry got a new lease on life. More and more farmers left the land for the pits and the mills. While they had now income-producing jobs, the working conditions were intolerable. The field was ripe for unions, and they grew with unprecedented speed. While the Western Federation of Miners had collapsed with the forced demise of the IWW, the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers was their reincarnation. Many of the former union's leaders and members transferred to the new union. Membership burgeoned with new unionists. The union, associated with the newly created Congress of Industrial Organizations, or CIO, soon became a dominant force in Utah union and political affairs, but with a chink in its armor. While many of the more radical IWW leaders had been driven into exile, prison, or even executed, many went underground only to reemerge as members and organizers and leaders of Mine Mill. Some of these radicals were committed communists. Even Utah had its communist Mine Mill leaders, though probably few in number. The real commitment of these communist leaders was obscured during World War II when the interests of Russia and the United States were merged. However, when the war ended and the national interests came into conflict, the true loyalty of these leaders became evident to and rejected by a substantial number of mine mill members. A number of Mormon Utah mine mill leaders, allied with leaders from other areas, opposed the national communist leadership and led a fight at their national convention in 1946 to depose them. They were unsuccessful, their rebellion costing them their membership in that union. However, they were successful in leading out of that international about half of Utah's locals and members. With the rash of strikes, the revelation of union corruption and communist union leadership, so well publicized in the post-World War II period, unions along with the nation reverted to reverted to conservatism, especially on union-related issues. Apostle Joseph F. Merrill of the Mormon Church had proposed a right-to-work league in the General Conference of the Church in 1941. He continued to speak out against unions in many subsequent general conferences. It became a very common theme, as did a number of other church leaders. The Deseret News maintained a constant anti-union barrage. In 1955, the Mormon-dominated legislature passed Utah's right-to-work law, which is still on the books and being enforced. Hoping to counteract the anti-union campaign, Utah's AFL and CIO unions combined in 1956 into the Utah State AFL-CIO. Most of its subsequent leaders have been Mormons, albeit relatively inactive in the church. Now, that's historical background. While Mormons as a whole constitute their proportionate share of union membership and leadership, about 21% of the heads of Mormon families in the U.S. belonging to a union in 1959, there is still an uneasy relationship between Mormons and unionists. There is a relatively strong undercurrent of opposition to labor unions among active church members and considerable antagonism by unionists towards the church's relatively conservative social, economic, and political policies. The negativism of active church members is probably created by a number of factors. One, there is a strong conservative middle class bias among active Mormons. This bias is seen in a study of church members in 1957, which showed that while Mormons as a whole were only slightly Republican, about one percentage point or two, 58% of the most active members were Republican-oriented, while only 31% of the least active were so inclined. The more active members were also better educated and more strongly white-collar, with much less likelihood of being union members. If anything, Utah Mormons have increased their Republicanism since that time. Union leadership, two. Union leadership, as well as LDS church membership and leadership, are very demanding. If dedicated Mormons must make a choice, they will frequently opt for the church, reducing their union roles as well as influence. Three, the historical antagonism of the editorial policy of the Deseret News, as well as a few church leaders, has made many Utah unionists antagonistic toward the church. The negativism of these general authorities is undoubtedly influenced by the fact that they are largely drawn from among white-collared, propertied, middle-class, business and professional leaders. In addition, even after their calls as general authorities, they apparently maintain close ties to the business community. A recent study shows that all of the members of the First Presidency, 11 of the 12 apostles, all of the presiding bishopric, and at least 12 of the members of the First Quorum of 70 have such ties, being officers or directors of various corporations. There is no known similar relationship with unions on the part of members of those bodies. Mormon unionists may consequently feel uncomfortable and even antagonistic toward and church leaders, especially on secular issues. Needing a labor union in their workplace, the Mormon unionists may feel greater discomfort in church than union meetings, driving them from church activity. Four, because of the middle class characteristics of most active Mormons, working class members may feel socially uncomfortable or even inferior. Many active Mormons assume that a good Latter-day Saint will be a Republican, well-educated, economically successful, and opposed to labor unions. When these views are expressed, they add discomfort to those who do not fit into the mold. Five, there is a built-in tendency for successful, self-employed, managerial, well-educated, and professional men to become local and regional church leaders. In conflicts between labor and management, they will tend to take pro-management, anti-union positions. They may even use their ecclesiastical authority in a secular way, contrary to what union members perceive as their best interests. Six, if a Mormon union leader continues to represent workers in opposition to any church leader, the union leader may well be seen as opposing, quote, duly constituted authority, unquote, and therefore on the road to apostasy, if not already there. Informal sanctions may be even placed on him or her church leaders and members for rebellion. On the other hand, if they give in to ecclesiastical leaders, their influence among union members will diminish, if not disappear. In 1965, the ailing president, David O. McKay, with the concurrence of his councils, issued a strong statement in opposition to compulsory unionism. It has since been used by union opponents as representing the official position of the church. However, since that time, Mormon leaders have been relatively quiescent on the subject of unions. Nevertheless, the Deseret News continues to challenge unions. In the editorial of 1981, we find that it lauded the advances made by American workers since the first Labor Day, maintaining, however, that much of the advance had come from and to union, non-union workers rather than the dwindling minority of unionized workers. While recognizing the need for big labor to counteract the excesses of big business, the editor suggested that the new generation of labor leaders should abandon compulsion, but rather win members by making unions, quote, less authoritarian, unquote, and more responsive to the rank and file, a theme which has been found in most Labor Day editorials for many, many years. There appears to be only one sticky point, so far as the church is concerned, in the propriety of Mormons belonging to labor unions, in spite of all this. While church leaders have at times been critical of the racketeering, corruption, lack of democracy, etc., that is sometimes found in some unions, most union leaders and members are also opposed to such aberrations. While church leaders have sometimes been critical of strikes, boycotts, and pickets, as long as they are primary and nonviolent, they would probably be recognized them as legitimate expressions of discontent in a democratic republic. Collective bargaining over hours, wages, and working conditions is probably acceptable, as it is to most church members. In a survey I took some time ago, 85% of the Mormon people approved of collective bargaining. The only real question that I see is over union security. The consistent position of church leaders has been that workers should not be required to join labor unions in order to hold a job. The theological support for this position comes from the doctrine of free agency, which they maintain is violated by requiring a worker to join a union. A committed union member, including most Mormon unionists, reply with several arguments. One, unions are no more likely to deprive members of their free agency than are such professional organizations as medical, dental, legal, and architectural societies or groups. Two, it is not unions that require membership to hold a job. It is the employer who determines worker qualifications. While a union may seek some form of union security to protect itself against anti-union employers, the employer ultimately makes the decision through a legal contract negotiated with the union. Three, even where a legal union security provision exists, workers still are free to think how they wish. They still have their agency. The limitations on action are no more onerous or destructive of agency than are those placed on workers by employers or government, and they add often, or even the church for that matter. Four, unions themselves are generally highly democratic, probably as democratic as more so than most economic and political institutions. Certainly most unions are at least as democratic as most employers. While Mormon unionists may have good arguments on their side, Mormon leaders are not likely to forgo opposition to compulsory unionism in the near future. Nor are union members likely to give up trying to achieve security for their unions in the face of persistent employer attempts to weaken or destroy them, which efforts seem to be on the increase today. There is, therefore, the potential for continued conflict between Mormonism and unionism unless some kind of accommodation over the question is made. The question is, can unions be reasonably secure short of employers agreeing to require their workers to join a labor union? For many years, I've been maintaining, I might say without noticeable effect, that a modified union security arrangement could provide the accommodation. I've suggested what is referred to as a maintenance of membership clause in labor contracts. Under such a clause, workers would not be required to join a labor union, but should they choose to do so, they would be required to remain members for a given period of time, usually the length of the contract, at the end of which time they would have a period when they could leave the union. As such a clause does not require union membership, it does not violate the historical position of church leaders. And while unions may not feel that it provides them adequate protection, perhaps it would be better than continued opposition by non-union Mormon members and leaders.
I appreciate the opportunity to respond to Ken's paper. I'm not sure that I'm all that well qualified. Peggy called me up and asked me to do this. My background is more finance. I'm not a historian. As you can see from Ken's paper, a good deal of his paper involves labor history. And I'm also not an expert in labor unions, and so I may disqualify myself in advance, and you should know that as a backdrop to my comments. I would like to give a brief overview of the paper from my perspective. I think it will be helpful in setting up the remarks that I'd like to make. I interpreted Ken as really dealing with three types of topics in the paper. The first, historical, the second, sociological, and the third, philosophical. In the historical section, which was really, I think, the primary body of the paper, Ken dealt with issues such as the origins of the conflict, having to do with the Mormon versus Gentile, who also happened to be union members, and that spilling over into Mormon union. The idea that some of the labor union movements initially had secrecy involved, the radical tendencies involved in some early union efforts, buyout, and so forth. In the sociological section of the paper, Ken introduced some data involving what Mormon socioeconomic status was, and suggested that maybe the socioeconomic status, particularly as it applied to church leaders and active members, may create a basis for opposition between the two groups. And finally, in the philosophical section of the paper, Ken outlined the arguments basically surrounding the issue of closed shops and right-to-work laws. As is expected, I think, at these sessions, I'm going to make some criticisms to the paper. However, in academic tradition, when you're reviewing a paper, there's usually one of two conclusions you can come to. One conclusion would be to recommend that the paper not be published, simply because it does not contain material of merit to see the light of day. The usual alternative is to say, I recommend the paper be published along with some revisions. And certainly my response to your paper, Ken, is of the latter form. I think there is a paper here that is publishable quality, but I do think there's some revisions that would improve the paper. Before I go into that, let me just offer two compliments. One, I found the historical section very enlightening. It's a topic I knew nothing about, and obviously Ken's done a great deal of work here and has written entire books, and I suspect that this is a form of condensation which really makes it more accessible to a number of people, and so I commend those efforts. The other part of the paper I found useful was the dealing with some of the union issues, particularly as they might relate to free agency within the church. And that was also, I think, enlightening to come across that material. The several criticisms, and I will follow the criticisms by suggested reworking that might take some account of the criticisms. first criticism, Ken, is I found the paper a little bit of a grab bag, and that, I think, ties the fact it contains some history, some sociology, and some philosophy, and I don't think they were melded together as well as they could have been. The title, and I hope this doesn't sound like a quibble over words, but I think the title illustrates some of the difficulty. Ken refers to the confrontation between Mormonism and Unionism as unique. Expected, given the connotation unique, perhaps the paper to say, look, unions and Mormons and unions should be expected to be allies. And for some reason or another, a confrontation has developed between what otherwise would be natural allies. Ken does not take that point of view in the paper. It's a point of view that could have been taken. Alternatively, I think a point of view surrounding the word unique could have been, look, as with any two competing organizations, you expect conflict, for example, between the Republican political party and the Democratic political party. We expect conflict. They're competing organizations. But somehow the conflict between Mormons and unions is unique. It's somehow different from the conflict we normally find between two competing organizations. Again, Ken didn't take that point of view. A third and a fourth would be that, look, unions have always had certain types of confrontations with organized religion. It so happens that the confrontation between unions and Mormons is unique, different from what unions normally encounter. Again, that point of view is not taken. Or similarly, it could have been Mormons always conflict with secular organizations, but the conflict between Mormons and unions is unique. And again, not that point of view. I would have the title better if the word unique would have been dropped, but that just solves the title problem. It really doesn't solve the issue of let us have a single theme in the paper. A second issue that, and this may just have been more conclusion drawing, because the paper started with history and what you might almost say is an historical accident in terms of the various conflicts that arose, I found myself wondering whether the conflicts between Mormons and unions were merely an outgrowth of essentially what is an historical accident. Say, for example, the Mormon-Gentile conflict, and because Gentiles happen to be involved in unions, therefore the conflict between Mormons and unions grew, or whether it was, in fact, more related to the basic philosophical purposes of the two organizations. Now, Ken hints at that, but he doesn't really deal with it. I think, particularly given your economics background, it would have been useful somewhere in the paper, if it were done along that lines, to deal with the problem of unions as monopolies, and why, as a monopoly, is the closed shop important, perhaps as a way to deal with the free rider problem and then deal with some of the pros and cons of that. I think the paper might have benefited from something like that. A couple of nitpick criticisms. I think that the paper is set up as Mormons versus unions, but really it's Utahns or Mormon Utahns versus unions. It'd be interesting to note that if you had Mormons in other parts of the country, particularly among new converts, are we getting a disproportionate number of Republican anti-union converts, say, in Ohio? Or what does that Ohio membership look like? Maybe the Ohio membership is heavily Democratic, pro-union kinds of things. So the paper, I think, in its title has a somewhat broader scope than it really deals with. I think it's dealing with Utah Mormons. Again, that's a quibble and nitpick. I found myself, although the paper is very well documented, there are a couple of statements in there that were tantalizing that I had wished for more documentation on. One is the idea that Mormon unionists may feel uncomfortable and hence drop out of church activity. That's not an absurd idea, but Even one example would have been interesting, although not proving anything, and certainly some data, if you had it, would have been nice. Or the statement, which was not in the original paper, but which you made in your presentation about the increasing republicanism among Mormons. I don't know. That may be, and if it's true, it would be interesting to hear a documentation on that. But in general, the paper was very well documented. Resolution. This is, of course, personal preference, and Ken is free to accept or reject this. I would have personally been more comfortable with a paper that was either strictly historical, alternatively strictly sociological, or alternatively strictly philosophical. I think the historical segments of the paper nearly form a complete paper, and with perhaps a different conclusion, would stand on its own as a contribution and something worthwhile talking about. Sociologically, again, Ken added something in his presentation that wasn't in my copy, but it was the tendency of Mormon bishops and leaders to be propertied and on board of directors, and of course with some sociological material in there, and you allude in the paper that in the early days there was flirtation and maybe some really pro-union sentiment, and I think we all have the feeling that the demographics of the church, particularly the relative demographics of the church, have evolved rather radically since its beginnings in the Midwest, and those changing demographics might give rise to changing attitudes towards union, and I think a paper could be built around that kind of idea. My favorite, however, would be a philosophical kind of paper. Ken, in a footnote, which he did not read in the interest of time, but defines Mormonism as a system of religion providing the solution to life's problems. He defines unionism as providing the solution, and he doesn't quite say life's problems, but he says political and economic problems. I found that tantalizing in the sense of saying maybe this paper could be structured as saying here we have two competing solutions to life's problems, and tried to work that way. Let me just take off one or two sentences here. Michael Novak has proposed that Americans tend to see three clusters of problems, maybe in contrast to Europeans who tend to see two clusters. We tend to break our problems down into political, economic, and moral, cultural. We see, for example, the political and economic spheres as distinct, whereas European predisposition tends to see politics and economics more of the same mold. And using that as a jumping-off place, historically, Mormonism has certainly been a religion which has tried to deal with all three of those areas, where many religions, of course, would confine themselves strictly to the moral cultural sphere, not get involved in politics, not get involved in economics. Similarly, are you signaling me that...
I can give you some good footnotes.
Let me take one more minute to give a concluding sentence, and then we'll turn the time over for some comments. But the point is that unions also, particularly of the Walter Ruther variety, wanted to speak in all three spheres, and instead of merely confining to the economic sphere, and so the confrontation is set up. And as the church withdraws and as unions withdraw, the conflict is lessened. Anyway, an enjoyable paper, and if Senator Moss would like to offer something, and I'd be delighted to hear it. No doubt.
Well, thank you. I think I can give up front. All right.
First of all, let me say that was an excellent paper, and historically, I thought you set the record out very well. But picking up now on the time of the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, which was under the Roosevelt administration, and the law of the land became, and still is, that those workers who wish to may join a labor union. They may bargain collectively on hours and wages and other conditions of labor, and that if they form a majority of the employees, the employer is required to bargain with the union and the union representatives. So that's what you always hear about the bargaining. Now, the problem came when the 80th Congress was elected and it went Republican in 1946. Bob Taft was the leader of the Republicans then, and they passed the Taft-Hartley Act. And the Taft-Hartley Act made some changes in the Labor Relations Act, and one, it gave over to the states the power to enact right-to-work laws. Now, that was the only thing that was carved out of the national law. The law was national, applied everywhere, except the states now were given the right for a right-to-work law. And Utah, as you documented, was one of the states that chose to use that part of the law and enact a right-to-work law. Then when the Congress went back, the executive went back, the Congress sooner, under John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, it was Lyndon Johnson the presidency by then, the a bill was proposed to repeal Section 14B, which is where they gave that special privilege to the states to have right to work law. They were going to repeal it if the law passed and go back where it was before, where the law would be entirely governed by the national action of the Congress. And so there was a very tight question on whether 14B would be repealed. And now this is where the church gets into it. The church had the position very much against repealing 14B. In other words, it wanted to keep the right to work, and it gave us its reasons. They didn't want any of their people required to join a union because they might have personal objection. So an amendment was made in the bill to say that no worker who didn't want to join the union was required to join the union. However, if the union bargained for him on wages and hours and other things, he had to pay his proportionate share of what it cost for that. In other words, he would have to pay some dues into the bargaining unit that spoke for him. Well, that was the point of conflict. The church got very much involved in it. And the president of the church, speaking for the brethren, wrote a letter to every Mormon in the Congress. Now, he didn't talk just to the Utah Mormons. He talked to the California Mormons, the Idaho Mormons, the Arizona Mormons. Every Mormon in the Congress got a letter, and the letter was couched to dear brother so-and-so, and said that it was the counsel given to him that the 14B should not be repealed. Well, as you can imagine, when that came, the brethren in the Congress didn't all line up. And a letter was sent back to the president of the church, signed by every Democratic member, Mormon, saying that in spiritual matters we will follow the church, in economic matters we will follow what we think is in the interest of the people we represent. And bang, there it was. It just disappeared. Nothing more was said. I later talked to Hugh. I somebody had to draft it. I later saw an interview in which Hugh Brown, who was then in the quorum but was not yet in the presidency, and they said to Brother Brown, what did you think about the letter that came back? He said, well, they told us to mind our own damn business, and that's what we should have done in the first place. Well, I've stated that rather tersely and strongly. There were a lot of surrounding factors, but there is definitely and remains to this day a church bias against union membership and in favor of the right to work law. And I decry that because I think it, you know, that all ought to be put to rest. We ought to have our individual free agency to do what we want to and not be dictated to on allegiance. And so long as the law of the land remains that the workers may organize and bargain collectively, they ought to be able to join a union if they want it.
I saw the senator sitting out there, and I knew that he had participated well in some of these things and would be able to offer us a good footnote. Thank you very much for being with us.